It is 5 o'clock, and you are listening to KDVS 90.3 FM. It's 5 o'clock on Tuesday, and as always, it's time for Office Hour. Before we begin, I want to remind you that the views that are presented in this show, they may not reflect the views of KDVS, the KDVS sponsors, or the University of California. So here it is, 5 o'clock on Tuesday. This is Professor J, otherwise known as Naomi Janowitz. And I am very happy to be here, as always, getting ready to go out and knock on someone's door and find out what's going on in this campus here. So you can hear me knocking on a door today, like we always do. And I think it's going to be a really interesting conversation today. We're knocking on the door of Michael Foster from East Asian Languages and Cultures. So welcome to the show, Michael.
Thank you very much.
Right. So if any of you have children who played with Pokemon cards, if any of you have ever been to Japan, if any of you are interested in going to Japan, if any of you are interested in folklore or want to know what folklore is, we're going to be talking about Japanese folklore today. But as always, before we begin to talk about Michael's particular articles about Japanese folklore, monsters, ghosts, and rituals, we always start with the same question, which is, I'm sure for our listeners, a bit of a puzzle, because some of them probably are not really sure what a folklorist does. So how do you wake up one day and decide you want to be a folklorist, right? And how do you decide you want to be a Japanese folklorist in particular? So how did that happen to you, Michael?
It's a great question and sort of an interesting story. It may be relevant to some of our listeners. When I was an undergraduate, I had no idea what I wanted to do except I wanted to be a novelist. I wanted to write stories and travel and meet people.
Mm-hmm.
So I was an English major in college with no easily employable skills when I graduated. I had a series of odd jobs, interesting jobs, and I traveled to Scotland.
Hmm.
So my interest in Japan and in folklore actually begins in Scotland, oddly enough. I went to Scotland because I'd spent a year abroad there, a junior year abroad, and I had friends and...
Right. We always pause for a second, remind everybody, junior year abroad. This is a small advertisement. Think how many people their lives are changed by going, so here you go to Scotland.
Yeah, so my life was changed by that. And the ironic reason for me going to Scotland was it was as far away as I could get in a foreign country where I didn't have to know a foreign language because all I knew was English. And I thought a Scottish accent was close to a foreign language, so that would be exciting for me. What I discovered in... So I went there for my junior year, went back to the U.S., finished my degree, and then I went back to Scotland to become a novelist. And while becoming a novelist or trying to become a novelist, I worked a series of jobs. I was a bar... not really a bartender, but I worked in a pub for a while.
Okay.
I was a carpenter's assistant. And eventually, while traveling, I met a guy who worked on a scallop farm on a small island off the coast of the western coast of Scotland in the Inner Hebrides.
Hmm.
And he was a fascinating guy. I had actually met him, I should step back, I met him my junior year abroad, and I kept a diary at the time, and I contacted him this time when I was in Scotland. I was living in Edinburgh, and I wrote to him, and I said, I'm tired of living in the city. Can you give me a job on your island? And he said yes. So I went to a small island with about 15 people.
Wow.
And I learned how to farm scallops. I only stayed there for about 3 months, but it was a fascinating experience for a lot of reasons. In part, and I realized only later, I learned a lot about oral narrative and telling, just speaking with the few people on the island, learning about their experiences, something that would be interesting to me later when I studied folklore. But more importantly, all the technology of scallop farming comes from Japan.
Ah, I was waiting for the Japanese connection. I was wondering how it was going to come in. So that was not what I was guessing. Okay.
So it's a kind of an obscure connection. And it stuck with me. I went back to the U.S. and I still wasn't ready to settle down to a normal job. And so I looked around and while working other odd jobs, I found something called the JET program, which a lot of our students in East Asian Languages and Cultures are aware of, which is a way in which American students, British students, French students, recent graduates from college mostly, can go to Japan and work in a school situation as an assistant language teacher. And this was just starting back in the late 80s when I was got involved in this. And I went and I was sent to a large industrial town in the south of Japan and a high school there. And it was and the reason I chose Japan was really relatively random. I was just looking for a way to get away from the U.S. and travel some more. And I thought that was a good place to go and a place to learn how to teach English. And then maybe I would move on to Spain or France or somewhere like that. And teaching English would be my ticket to travel and have experiences and write about them. I ended up staying in Japan for about 4 years.
Wow.
That first time. And one of the ironic thing was that I was still kind of obsessed with scallop farming. I had wanted to become a scallop farmer after working in Scotland. And I realized that Japan was the place where this started. So I was in the south of Japan and I asked a lot of people. Whenever I went to a fish market, I learned the first words I knew in Japanese were hotate gai no yoshoku, which means scallop farming. Which is a strange set of words to learn. But I ended up, I would ask people where the scallops were from, and I learned they were from the way north of Scotland. I'm sorry, of Japan.
Right.
The far north of Japan, about as far away from, very far from where I was actually living. So I lived in Japan, worked and learned Japanese while teaching English, and I lived there for about 3.5, almost 4 years. And it wasn't until the very last few months I was there, I took some time off, I had saved some money, and I traveled up to the north of Japan to where scallop farming is done.
Well, that was a long apprenticeship before you finally got to the scallop area.
And there were other reasons, too. There's a Japanese author. I was also very interested in literature, and there's a Japanese author named Dazai Osamu who came from that same area just by chance, so I thought it would be nice to see his hometown. But on the way to that area, I got caught in a terrible rainstorm and ended up in a small town, not quite that far north. Stayed at a very cheap bed and breakfast. And the woman who ran the bed and breakfast, I chatted with her. And at that point, I knew Japanese, so we could have a very nice conversation. And she told me, she said, "You seem to be very interested in Japanese culture. If you're interested in that, you should go to the next town over," which is where, and I remember she used this weird phrase. She said, "That's where the legends are born." And I didn't know what she meant by that.
Legends being born might be even more interesting than scallops
right,
being
exactly,
born.
Right, exactly. So I thought, well, I'll stay an extra few days. And I went to that village. And that village, the history of that village is that in 1910, a person who I learned later was the most famous, sort of the founder of folklore studies, of folkloristics in Japan, had written a book about that particular town. Mm. And now the town had sort of developed a tourist industry around the legends and the folk tales that had been written about in that book. So that was really my first introduction to Japanese folklore and to this particular town and the idea of collecting legends and writing about them. I started reading the book actually while I traveled up and met some scallop farmers. And then after that, I left Japan and went to UC Berkeley for graduate school. At that point, I had decided I wanted to study something. Mm-hmm. I didn't know what I wanted to study, but I had learned enough Japanese that I thought it should have to do with Japan. I thought maybe political science, maybe literature. But to make a very long story short, I ended up at a master's program in Asian studies at UC Berkeley, studying political science, which I didn't have an affinity to. So I ended up studying literature. And in one of my literature classes, pre-modern Japanese literature, I asked the faculty member, the professor, if I could write a paper about that book of legends that I had collected. And he said no.
Oh, well, that's a very good start for your career.
Well, it actually was, because what he said was, he said no, and the reason is, first of all, this is a pre-modern literature class, and that book is modern, and that's very important in a Japanese context where modernity came rather rapidly at the end of the 1800s. This book was written in 1910, and then he said, also, it's not folklore. Oh, I mean, it's not literature, it's folklore. And I didn't really know that there was much of a distinction at that point. But then he said, if you're interested in folklore, you're at the right place because there's a very famous folklorist who teaches at this university, a guy named Alan Dundas. He doesn't do anything with Japan, but you should go talk to him and take his classes. And so I did. And when I went to his class, I sat in on his undergraduate class and eventually took his graduate seminars. And I realized when he introduced what folklore was and what it was that folklorists study, that that's what I had been interested in all along.
But nobody had quite explained to you what it was.
Exactly. I didn't really know the word that went with those things that were interesting to me, that I was finding fascinating.
Mm-hmm. So that's pretty late. That means you're already in your graduate classes.
Yeah.
And you're looking around. So I think that's a very interesting story. You're looking around, you kind of know the area, you have the expertise of the language. But the question is, what type of culture, what area of culture is it that is the most enticing and motivating for you?
Yeah. So with that sort of, I mean, and I guess this is where the idea of folklore came into it. What I realized was exciting to me was the sort of non-institutional, non-doctrinal, non-formal forms of processes that people go through to learn about their own world and, mm-hmm. and to live a kind of everyday life, but an everyday life peppered with special occasions, festivals, events. And there's no rules for how that's done. There's no rules about how to have a wedding. And yet people in a particular culture will know the proper way to do that wedding. The rules mm-hmm. aren't written down.
Mm-hmm.
And it was that kind of thing that really somehow, and I'm not sure why, but it really excited me. And I think it may have tied into my experience in Scotland, where I traveled a lot, I actually hitchhiked a lot, and met a lot of people. And they always told me about their own lives and what was valuable mm-hmm. to them. And it often revolved around rituals and ceremonies and stories that they had heard from other people. And there was a kind of intertwined network of ideas and narratives and ways of interacting with people that I found really interesting.
A lot more interesting than political science classes.
Yeah, a lot more interesting
than political science. So do you think that you were particularly lucky in that Japan has rich oral traditions? And that there was that you were just plain lucky that Scallops ended you up there, that that's a great place to ask some of the questions that you're interested in asking? Or do you think just that would be true anywhere?
I think I'm lucky in the sort of series of events that let me discover that those were my interests. Mm-hmm. But I think it could happen anywhere.
It could happen anywhere. So folklore is everywhere.
Folklore is definitely everywhere.
And how would you then, for our listeners, how do they know when they stumble, if they stumble this evening across some folklore, how would they know they were encountering folklore?
So that's one of the hardest questions to ask a folklorist. and I will try to keep my answer relatively simple. But I think one way to think about what folklore is first of all, not necessarily as a product, but as a process.
Mm.
And often as a kind of process of communication.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a process that's often these are not sort of definitive characteristics, but orientations. A lot of folklore is the process of communicating how to do something is informally done.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where it gets, so for example, how to have a wedding. Mm-hmm. this is something, I'm using that as a kind of general example, but every culture's got different procedures, different rituals, different formal language used in a wedding. And sometimes those are written down, but in many cases, it's word of mouth. It's passed from person to person in an informal manner. You don't mm-hmm. You don't take a class on how to have a wedding. And that's a weird example, but that's one example of a sort of age-old way of interacting. But another one would be, for example, that our listeners might encounter tonight is how to do something on a computer.
Mm.
On an iPhone or something, the techniques involved, there's a kind of knowledge that they may learn from a friend.
Mm-hmm. That makes it folklore.
And to my mind, that's part of a folkloric process.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
that's very important. In the things that people study, the items, the products of folklore that people tend to study, we used to, or folklorists used to study oral tradition.
Right.
You know, and that was often orality was considered one of the sort of hallmarks of folklore. Mm-hmm. We don't say that anymore because there are so many forms of non-oral folklore that are just as meaningful. Mm-hmm. I think what we often talk about on the internet, viral things that go viral, even memes, mm-hmm. Are very much a form of contemporary folklore.
Mm-hmm. It certainly does say that in terms of, if that's the emphasis in folklore, it says something about how you study, because of what, a lot of what you do must be sort of participatory, that you participate in trying to understand how things are passed on through these informal networks.
Right, and that's, I think that's one of the things that excited me most about it, is that in learning how to do these, you can't go to school and learn how to, you know, create a viral video or memes. But in originally, 5 or 10 years ago, that was something you would learn just through interaction or watching people. And as a student of that, you would have to either be part of that community or do kind of a participant observation study, research within that community.
Right.
A lot of the most interesting information comes out casually in casual conversation, informal interactions with people.
So that means that a lot of your papers are kind of hanging around with Japanese friends, right?
and
seeing what interesting things are happening in their rituals and how they prepare for them and how they carry them out. And the first one that I want to talk about, which I thought was just a wonderful paper, is Inviting the Uninvited Guest, Ritual Festival Tourism and the Namahage of Japan. So here you're looking at the intersection, which I'm sure many of our listeners have encountered, that weird intersection between somebody having a ritual, putting on a ritual, and somebody else, in this case, tourists, watching it. And how can we make sense of this? I've certainly seen this all over the world. And it is a little disconcerting to see and to wonder what is the meaning of the ritual from the people participating in it, and then what is the meaning for the people who are watching it, and how can we sort of understand it? So maybe you want to tell us first a little bit about this particular ritual and maybe why you think this ritual was such a good one to use in your article.
Okay, great. That's a great, I think you've sort of phrased that beautifully. And so this particular ritual is called the Namahage, and it's a, I often like to describe it as a kind of inverse Halloween experience.
That's good. I like that.
So it takes place on New Year's Eve. In one part of Japan, a place called Oga, the Oga Peninsula of Akita Prefecture, way up in the north of Japan, takes place on New Year's Eve. And what happens, and I'm reducing this and sort of summarizing it, but groups of usually young men will gather together in a little village community, and they'll put on masks, demon masks, very frightening, colorful masks, all sorts of, each community has slightly different variety, but they'll put on these masks. A straw raincoat, and they'll carry knives. The knives are made of wood, but they look quite realistic, and especially in the dark. Knives and other sort of threatening sticks and posts and staffs and that sort of thing. And they go from house to house, banging on the doors, bursting into the household, scaring the kids and chasing the children around and saying, are there any lazy kids here? If they are, we'll take you away to the mountains, and threatening the kids, basically. Mm. They used to actually also threaten younger members of the household, particularly women, newlywed brides who had moved into the household. They don't do that as much anymore. It's mostly focused on children. And then they'll sort of quiet down, and the household, the family, will offer them some drink, sake, beer, and also some specialties of the region. A fish called hata hata, in particular, and they'll eat with them, and just for a few minutes, and sip some of the alcohol, and then they'll get up and threaten again, and then they'll wish them fortune for the new year and for the rest of the year. And they threaten to come back again and tell the kids they have to behave themselves and not be lazy. Mm-hmm. And they go off and they go up to the next household.
Mm-hmm. Now, and this is supposed to be frightening.
It is supposed to be frightening. And it is frightening for the kids.
It is frightening for the kids.
Yeah.
So, but you talk about new versions of this, one of which takes place in a hotel, which seems to be somewhat of a rethinking of the ritual.
Right. And that's where this gets interesting. And to get to the research aspect of this and how I started getting interested in not only the ritual itself, but the way it's rethought and reconfigured for other purposes, The first time I went to see this, and I went to see it because I was interested in scary things, and that's a whole nother story. But I went on New Year's Eve, and I didn't know anything. I just thought I'd go for the first time, and I went to a hotel that was recommended to me by actually my professor in Japan. And I met the owner of the hotel, and I told him I wanted to witness this. And he said, oh, no problem. They come to the hotel. And that sort of shocked me because I had read it takes place in people's houses. And then I said, well, doesn't it take place in a house? Can't I go to a house? And he said, oh, well, yeah, you can. Let me introduce you to some people. So eventually, through being somewhat pushy, and he being a wonderfully generous person who I'm still in touch with, this was 20 years ago, actually, but he set me up with the people who were actually performing the role of the Namahage, and I traveled with them, walked with them through the snow from house to house, and then eventually to the hotels. This particular community had a bunch of hotels in it. So quite early on, I'm not sure what year, but probably in the 70s, they had decided that people were coming to the region in the winter, staying in these few hotels. They're hot spring hotels, so they're kind of resorts. They're
touristy not, already.
Touristy, yeah. And this is a kind of remote region, so these are people who are really into hot springs. they were staying there, and they were interested in Namahage. But it was not an appropriate thing for them to go into somebody's house like I was doing, but I was only one person. So they decided that what a great tourist thing, but to have the Namahage come to the hotel, and which they did, and they chased the guests around the lobby, and so it's a really interesting reconfiguration. It's the same Namahage, the same night, the same place, and yet the people who they're chasing around, the people they're scolding, are not the kids who grew up in the neighborhood, but people who are visiting just for one or two nights in the community. So I found this distinction and the overlap with the ritual itself to be really fascinating.
Now, are these people paying for the ritual? And I realize that's only just part of the whole question of tourism. Yeah. But or does it just, are they in a way sort of just included in the ritual just because the ritual is sort of expanded out to the whole city? And therefore, just sort of an expansion into the hotel. But the hotel is understood to be sort of like someone's house. And they don't actually buy a ticket for it, per se, or something like
right.
that.
Right. No, their ticket is just to pay to stay at the hotel.
Right, right.
I think that's exactly, I mean, in a way, it's very natural for the hotel to be incorporated into it because that's a household, as it were. And the people, like my friend Yamamoto-san, who runs this hotel, I mean, he grew up in the community, and these, even if there were no tourists, they would still come to his hotel probably for him. But because there's tourists, they might as well include the tourists, and this in itself becomes an event. Yeah, they don't pay extra for that. That's kind of a freebie for staying there that particular night.
So I guess in a way you could think there are many ways in which the idea of the uninvited guest occurs in this activity. And that's one of the things I think was so charming. As you were explaining it, because first of all, the demons or these figures are uninvited in a certain kind of way. You don't necessarily want them coming to your house.
The children certainly don't. They're frightened for days in advance.
And then you have tourists who are sort of an uninvited guest as well. So are there some kind of, are they sort of like structural parallels of each other, or how would you explain that?
I think there are sort of structural parallels there. And the term uninvited guest that I used for the article, I actually borrowed from a Japanese folklorist, sort of theorist named Orikuchi Shinobu, who theorizes that, and I say theorizes because he doesn't have all that much historical basis for this. It's sort of, he's playing a little bit playing games with history, but it's a nice idea, I think. And he talks about the way in which there used to be a pattern of guests from outside a community who would come into a particular community. He called that maribito. They were a rare visitor, a stranger who would be treated like a god. And those people were actually, in a way, invited. They were expected to come at a certain time. And the Namahage have been conflated with that idea, because they are expected to come every New Year's Eve, and they're frightening, but they bless the community and they act as a kind of god. I often call them demon deity figures because they're mm-hmm. neither a demon nor a deity, but a mixture of both, and they're very potent in that sense. And they they're an expected rare visitor. But then he also had this idea of the uninvited guest, and that's the person who sees something interesting going on and pokes his head in, basically, a kind of passerby or a rubbernecker, as it were. And there's a moment, I think, in tourism and in this kind of shift in the ritual in which the uninvited guest, in this case, the hotel guest who just happened to come that night, they weren't really invited to the ritual,
yes.
but they come on that night, and then there's a moment where the hotel owners decide, well, let's invite the uninvited guests. So mm-hmm. suddenly the uninvited guests, the hotel, people staying at the hotel, are the ones who are being treated in a way like gods themselves. They're mm-hmm. being treated to a performance.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an interesting shift, I think.
So what do you think we can take away from that about these complex social relations? On the one hand, the gods come and are frightening, but they do leave, and then yeah. you have a whole year before they're going to come back and frighten you again. And on the tourism is a mixed thing.
Yeah,
they're kind
yeah.
of, the people are sort of annoying, but then on the other hand, they're bringing money and they're participating in the ritual in a certain, almost a kind of deference because
yeah.
they're interested in the ritual. So maybe all of these stories are about sort of how do we deal with inside-outside relationships.
I think that's absolutely the case. There's a kind of negotiation that goes on constantly. And I think, I'm talking about an extreme case, but I think we do that in all of our lives to a certain extent. We
yes.
negotiate, when a good friend comes to visit, after 3 days you want them to go home, right? So there's that kind of negotiation going on there all the time. And I do think it's crystallized in this kind of tourist relation. And I know from my friend who works at the hotel, who owns the hotel, that they're incredibly welcoming to their guests because they're paying guests, bringing money, but they're also relieved when they leave.
Yes.
And that happens all the time.
What do you think makes watching these so appealing to the outsider? Why? I mean, tourism is certainly, I passed through Amsterdam this summer mm-hmm. and there was nobody who wasn't a tourist in the town. And you could see the pull of that town for many different reasons. But the pull of tourism
yeah.
is quite amazing. And you talk a little bit about that tourists want to have a certain kind of an experience, and that by being able to watch or vaguely participate in something like a ritual, somehow that seems like more Japanese than other things they might have done.
Yeah, I think, and I should mention, most of the tourists in this case are actually Japanese tourists.
That's right, that's right.
There are some foreigners, of course, yeah. And actually more and more Chinese tourists and Korean tourists as well, Asian tourists. But most of the people participating in this, visiting this, are Japanese. But they're not from this kind of rural community. They're from the cities. They may have descended from a rural environment, but they've grown up in the cities. So I think there is, one of the great theorists of tourism, Dean McCannell, who's
yes.
actually a UC Davis professor,
yes.
Posited this idea of tourists wanting to see the backstage. So, anybody can go to the Eiffel Tower and see that. That's a tourist experience. But it'd be much more exciting if you were able to go into, the control room of the Eiffel Tower and see how it actually operates. And I'm just making that up.
No, I understand.
But the idea of getting behind the scene that's presented to you, seeing how the operations really work. And I think that idea, and it's been developed and questioned and manipulated, that sort of theory is a very basic idea that's been played with a lot. But I do think in the case of Namahage and in the case of many rituals in rural Japan, there's a desire on the part of the tourists, often from cities, to see something that they can't see, see something that they might deem, to use a very vexed word, authentic.
Right.
Something.
Exactly.
A real life experience that is being shown to them unmediated by mm-hmm. television, unmediated by tourism in a way. Of course, it's ironic because they're tourists, right? So it's this really brilliant irony, I think, that occurs there all the time.
And maybe it's something that they feel ambivalent about in the way that they feel it, that they've lost it in their life.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, they don't want to participate in it from the inside. So that gives them that kind of, what could we say, liminal capacity to both be part of it and not part of it, which is in some ways very satisfying.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's exactly the case. If they were to move into the community, become part of this, after a number of years, it just becomes their life. There's nothing authentic about it in the sense, except in the sense that there's nothing desirably authentic about it, I should say, if they're living there. But as a visitor, they get to see something, a little glimpse of somebody else's truth, mm-hmm. somebody else's private life, and that to them has some attraction, I think. Mm-hmm. And exactly as you said, then they can leave, and then they can tell people about it.
Right. So they don't have to, as you're saying, they don't have to actually learn how to do these things
right.
or participate or necessarily believe in them
right.
in any
right.
kind of way.
Right.
They're simply, do you think there's also something about religious rituals that are very appealing for tourists as opposed to other kinds of things they might chance upon or that might be taking place, that there's a kind of authenticity? There's sometimes people think, even if it isn't necessarily true, that these are very, very old traditions, and therefore they're also getting a glimpse into the far into the
yeah.
past.
I think yeah, that's absolutely the case, and absolutely the case with this as well. I mean, the early folklorists who explored it saw this as what we would call in a survival, something that
right.
somehow managed to survive from the ancient times. Of course, we don't know how old it is. The Namahage, we do know that Namahage, we have a date before which it must have existed, and that date's not that old. It's 1811, which
old,
is the
right.
first documented image of it. Somebody drew a picture of the Namahage. So certainly it existed before that, and it may go back centuries. We don't know. But whatever the case, the early Japanese folklorists and people even today think of this as a glimpse of a non-modern,
long gone
ritual that still exists in this one cherished community, and that attitude I think does pervade tourism as well. And
mm-hmm. you yeah. can go back. You're an invited guest also in terms of time, and not
right.
only in space. You're invited into another time, which again you probably wouldn't wanted to have lived then,
right,
but you
right.
could have a short visit, and that's probably the best way to deal with that. So
right,
terrific.
Yeah.
Well, we have come to the end of the first segment of Office Hour today. This is Professor Jay, otherwise known as Naomi Janowitz, and I'm talking with Michael Foster from the East Asian Languages and Culture Department. And we're going to turn next to Japanese monsters. And I imagine that all of our listeners have in one way or the other run into a Japanese monster in the last while because they're so pervasive in culture. So stay with us and we will be back after some announcements. So you are back now. Here we are for the second half of Office Hour today talking about Japanese folklore. I, having raised two boys who are now past this stage, but they went through the Pokemon phase. And so when I was reading your article about the history of Japanese monsters, I was quite struck about how central monsters are in Japanese culture, and then how important they've become in general global society as well. And I'm quite struck by that. Before we go on to the global point, we want to backtrack a little bit to just the role of monsters in Japanese society. And you say that monsters have always been very important, and they also seem to, historically, we get new ones developing and old ones dying out. So maybe you can give us some examples of sort of the changing look of Japanese monsters.
Sure. Yeah. And I should step back and say the reason I was interested in Namahage was because I was interested in Japanese monsters.
Right.
So
the
two came sort of simultaneously. And the reason I was interested in Japanese monsters actually goes back to the time I was in grad school studying with Alan Dundas, and I had to write a very long paper, which eventually became my master's thesis. And I didn't know what to write about because I really had very broad interests. But I had on the tiny little refrigerator in my studio apartment, I had a little statue of something. And what it was a creature called a kappa, a little mm-hmm. a Japanese water creature that's ubiquitous. You can find it anywhere. There are kappa narratives and kappa belief systems throughout Japan in every prefecture, as far as I know. And it's a little demonic water creature that has all kinds of characteristics, such as yanking children and horses into the water and killing them. It's also it happens to like cucumbers, and if anybody likes a kappa roll or a kappa maki at the sushi shop, those are named after kappa and the fact that they like cucumbers. So they're very interesting little creatures, and I ended up writing my master's thesis on the kappa.
Mm-hmm.
That research into the kappa specifically made me realize that there was a whole field of research in Japan on what's called yokai, or Japanese monsters. And reading about that, I eventually started exploring more and more and trying to figure out what it was about those monsters, Japanese mm-hmm. yokai, that made them pervasive, made them something that people were willing to study seriously. And I wrote my PhD dissertation on Japanese monsters. And I happened to be in Japan just when it was really taking off as a field of study, actually.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things that I realized was that, of course, every culture has monsters.
Absolutely.
Every culture has scary things. Every
yes.
culture has an other that is frightening. But why were they so pervasive in Japan? So pervasive enough to eventually, I think, lead into things like Pokemon and Yokai Watch and all sorts of popular culture manifestations. And I think what I realized was it wasn't that, and people have often asked me this, and I've thought a lot about it, actually, since I wrote that article even more, why they're so pervasive in Japan. Is there something fundamental about the way that Japanese belief systems approach these? And I don't really think that's the case. I think there's a lot of factors, but one of the main factors is location. Often monsters are associated with a specific location.
And that's special to Japan.
So that's special to Japan or rural areas with a long... unlike the United States, where so many people are immigrants or the children of immigrants or descendants of immigrants, I think these kinds of beliefs don't necessarily travel with people if they're associated with the land.
Mm-hmm.
But there are places in Europe, in parts of Germany, parts of Britain... and Ireland, of course, there's deeply embedded folk cultural monsters and strange mm-hmm. creatures that are very much associated with places.
Yes.
And I think that's one reason in Japan that they were very strong.
Because mm-hmm. They have very strong local identities.
Yes, yes. Just like the Namahage only takes place in one part of Akita, for example, one part of the north of Japan. So that kind of local identity. Rituals are identified with specific places. Now, of course, there's different versions and variants. Kappa is found all around mm-hmm. Japan, but each community will have historically its own particular legend.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a very interesting point, and it sort of connects with the question that I was asking, which is about how they then also develop historically, because you both have... a commitment to monsters in locales, but you also have write quite a bit of historical change around monsters, as if they're very closely connected to certain social issues.
Yeah, and that's where it gets interesting, I think. So that's the association with location is, I think, a kind of fundamental sort of a base
mm-hmm.
that existed. But then, and this gets very much into the Japanese historical, into Japanese history, during the Edo period, which was about 1603 to 1868, it's a time period in which there was relative peace in Japan, no major wars, and also relative isolation from other countries. There was a purposeful policy of isolating, not allowing foreigners and foreign influences into the country. Relatively, there were some, of course, but at that time there was also a thriving urban culture. People were moving to Edo, which was the name of Tokyo before it became Tokyo. And Edo was actually, at a certain point during, I think in the early 1800s, actually larger than Paris. So
wow.
It was a major metropolitan center. And part of what occurred there was a thriving entertainment industry, which included woodblock prints. Many people, actually, there's an exhibit at the Manete Shrem right now with some woodblock prints, ukiyo-e. So a thriving print culture and also a thriving book culture. And really the precursors of today's manga, the comic, the graphic novels that people are reading today in Japan and elsewhere as well. And one of the things that occurred there was a lot of people moved from the countryside. They brought with them, and I'm simplifying here, but they brought with them their beliefs and their
monsters,
their legends and their knowledge, and they shared it, and they told stories, and they drew pictures of these things, and the pictures were often, sometimes very comical and cute, sometimes frightening, and so ghost stories were circulating both orally, but also in writing. And also in kabuki drama, for example, and bundaku puppet theater. So there was an entire popular culture entertainment industry that developed in Japan, starting in the 1600s. And part of that were monsters. And I think it's because of that monsters retained a kind of persistence and also changed to meet specific circumstances and thrived.
So you're saying that in a certain historical period, they became very embedded in sort of the cultural discourse in a very eclectic way because everybody had brought their local monsters into town. And they sort of had a sharing of these traditions.
Yeah.
And it's sort of so that monsters got added to monsters. I think maybe the example that I found the most interesting was the addition, was it the slit-eyed woman?
Slit-mouthed woman.
Right. So that we see then, because this takes place past that period, that then another type of a monster, this woman, suddenly appears on the social scene and plays a role sort of in the group psyche of thinking about femaleness, it seems.
Yeah, and that's, so I think any time a monster sort of takes on a viral legendary character and we analyze the particular moment at which it emerges, there's something going on there.
Yes.
There's some relationship to some kind of social anxiety or something happening in the community or the culture. And the one that you mentioned is actually one of the more recent examples of that. And therefore, because it's more recent, sort of easier to analyze. We have more documentation about it. And that occurred in actually 1979. The December of 1978, there was suddenly a kind of a phenomenon that was happening across Japan where kids were scared to go to school because of something called the Kuchisake Onna, or the slit-mouthed woman. And the legend that was associated with her was that it was a woman who was wearing a mask, a surgeon's mask, that often in Japan at that time and even more now, people wear a white mask to cover their face if they have a cold or they're afraid of germs or something like that. Now they use it for allergies as well, and we see it here in the U.S. as well occasionally. But in the 1970s, that was something very common in Japan, and the story was that a woman dressed like that in her 20s, a fairly attractive woman with long black hair often, sometimes a raincoat, there were different versions, would approach a child as he was going home from school and say to him, "Am I pretty?" Which, of course, is a very strange thing to ask a random kid. And the kid would look at her, quizzically, and then she would remove the mask and reveal that her mask was slit from ear to ear. And then she would say, "Even like this, am I pretty?" And then there are all kinds of parts of the story where she would chase the child or whatever, different variations. But that was the basic core of it. Mm-hmm. And
there just suddenly was a whole lot of concern about this particular monster appearing in a particular culture at a particular setting at a particular time. That's quite an incredible story,
right? I was very interested in this story. I actually heard it from somebody who had experienced it as a child. Had talked about when she was in, I think, third grade, how she was afraid to go to school. So this was a real thing. It lasted for about 6 months. But then I thought, something must be going on there. So I started doing research on this. And it was actually really kind of exciting research because people had recorded this. But one of the things they had recorded was that it often appeared in mass media, that it rapidly, because this was a time of mass media, oral tradition was, of course, oral tradition is always existing. But the word of mouth telling of this legend was perhaps less pervasive than the written version of it. And so I went to, there's a wonderful research facility in Tokyo where they've kept all kinds of popular magazines. So including things like the Japanese version of Playboy and things that people usually don't keep. And they're all in this library. And so I just started looking at a lot of these magazines, and I found that there was actually a lot of commentary on this Kuchisake Onna legend in women's popular magazines at the time. And I started reading the articles about them, and they often would have, there's one I remember very distinctly, had a picture of a woman, a before picture, just a normal-looking 20-something woman, and then an after picture, and that was with her made up with a mask and a slit in her mouth for the picture that was being used in the article. So she was the actor who was being used for this, but they had a before and after picture of her. Hmm. And then I started reading more through these articles, not just about Kuchisake Onna, not just about the slit-mouthed woman, but other articles in the same magazine. And I realized that so many of them were about transforming yourself, and yourself in this case being women, to look pretty. So it was, and that before-after picture is the inverse of the normal before-after picture you find for a.
Where it's supposed to look better after.
Right, right.
Or,
after you get
you
the makeup.
You shouldn't have paid for it.
Right, right. And the irony of that was really powerful, and I realized that that had something to do with what the Kuchisake Onna was saying. She was a phenomenon that grew out of a concern with women's role in society, and this was a moment actually when. Women's rights. There was a what they called a women's liberation movement that was very strong at that time in Japan, and really had affected society. And it really sort of shook up society, shook up the very patriarchal society. And this was, we could analyze it as a kind of backlash to that, or a representation of it. Of women saying, "Is you know, to be very simplified about it, is it only my appearance that's important to you? What if I show you what I've really had to go through for this appearance, or whatever?" So there's a lot of ways in which we can sort of posit the anxiety of that legend emerging from this moment of questioning what it means to be a woman in Japanese society at that time.
Well, it's not, I mean, it's quite striking to me that these women become monsters. And that's what we're talking about, that the monsters are very, I mean, one of the things we're learning is that monsters are very useful for society to think with, as we say.
Right, right.
So therefore, you have both the agglutination, you have a lot of available monsters as the culture urbanizes.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you have a lot of social issues in which you sort of think through them by imagining a new type of a monster, this woman. How does a monster phase come to an end? I mean, how did they get everybody? I mean, what happened? Does a monster just sort of naturally fade away after a while? Or
you know, it's a good question. With that particular monster, as I said, she was incredibly big for 6 months, and then what happened? And one analysis of that I read, that she just sort of started to fade from. She wasn't feared anymore, as it were. And one analysis I read was that the typical television series at that time was 6 months long. So that was the attention span of people to be fascinated with this. But I think also there was a saturation in the media. And there was a moment there, too, which I found fascinating, where this legend, and this is where the distinction between folklore and popular culture is actually quite interesting. The legend, which had emerged, from people telling stories and then people writing about the stories, was taken up by the media. So there's actually a song about Kuchisake Onna that was produced around that time. I found out later it was never released, but I read about it being produced. And she became a popular culture icon rather than something that people were really afraid of. Having said that, I thought she would disappear. And when I first started doing research on this, actually in the early 2000s, she was pretty much somewhat forgotten. But since that time, there's actually been at least two or three movies about her. She's moved on. There's a Korean version of the slit-mouthed woman. So she's still...
listeners. She's coming around.
Yes. Yeah. And my students all know her. So she never really disappeared.
She never disappeared. She just, as you say, she got picked up by the media. And the media, you know, people do have a... There's only a period for which anything will stay on the media. The media feeds on changing its memes all the time. So then we come to Pokemon. When I took my children around the world and they were little, Pokemon was great for them because it was an international language. They could play Pokemon with anybody, no matter whether we were in Europe or whether we were in the Middle East. because other kids would have Pokemon cards and it didn't matter if you could speak another language with them. You could
trade
cards.
It's the language of monsters.
It's the language of monsters turned out to be the true Esperanto of the world in a way that Esperanto never worked. And I remember how intrigued my children were. I sort of saw it as right after the dinosaur phase, In other words, something, but dinosaurs are very large and they're very small. So I think dinosaurs are very interesting to children around the size issue. The monster issue was sort of more about personalities and anger and all of those kinds of things. But I'm very curious because you argue that the Pokemon is the Japanese monsters going global and that they're almost not Japanese anymore per se, but they are part of sort of a global monster fixation or, using monsters. So how do you think that happened? Do you think that, again, was just some luck that the Japanese monsters were very appealing? So if you're going to globalize a monster, they had such a rich vocabulary that it would rush into the sort of become internationally important? Or do you think there's something specially internationally appealing about this specific Japanese monsters?
I wish I knew. If I knew, I could market that somehow. But but I think one of the things... I don't know if there's an easy answer to that question, but I think one of the things that happens with Pokemon, and I should say that Pokemon are a wonderful mixture of, quote, real monsters, so Japanese monsters with some historical relevance in Japan, and absolutely fabricated monsters. And I think that's always happened as well with monsters, of course. And that's one of the beautiful things about them is that it's very hard to define a monster. You can make it out of anything. It can be anything that you create. So there's this kind of infinite creativity involved. And I think that's actually one of the attractive things about Pokemon. As you said, they don't, to somebody in the know about certain ones, there may be some specific allusions to existing narratives or existing legends or existing belief systems. But you don't need that to appreciate them. They're a language of their own in one sense. So I think that's one of the attractive things about them, one of the things that allowed them to burst into the scene. I think the other aspect of, and I'm not an expert on Pokemon, but I think the other aspect of the attraction of them is that they're what is often called a media mix thing, a multi-platform format. So you can play cards, you can play Game Boy. Now, of course, Pokemon Go, you can play on your cell phone. So there's many different ways you can engage with them. So it's an entire universe that we have access to through different modes of communication and different media. And I think that's one of the things that makes them multicultural, as it were, or international, or accessible to so many people.
It's appealing to parents because they can always find another thing that they can get to entertain their children for longer, as you say, as they move from platform to platform. I was sort of wondering whether it wasn't also sort of monotheistic envy, you know, in the sense that, you know, you had the capacity to imagine a kind of supernatural beings. Not super supernatural, but clearly not humanoid.
Yeah.
In such a rich way of combinations that there was just a kind of a striking breadth to being supernatural that permitted our imagination to, in a way, just go in many directions.
I think that's absolutely true. I think that's one of the sort of enduring reasons why monsters in general are attractive, even though they're frightening, you know, things in many cases. They also represent possibility. They represent the unimagined thing that we can now imagine. And that sort of opens up so many realms of potential for people. So there's an incredible freedom of imagination. And yet at the same time, and this is another thing that's attractive, I think, about Pokemon, And in fact has historical roots in the way people understood Japanese monsters, is they can also be categorized and organized.
Yes.
And there's
a
desire to take this chaos, as it were. This, so Pokemon is, you know, have Pokedex, right? They're literally put into an index, into an encyclopedia. And if we look at the history of Japanese monsterdom, in the early Japanese encyclopedias, illustrated encyclopedias from the early 1700s, started organizing monsters. They started, everything was being, and it wasn't only monsters, though. It was, there was an interest in organizing everything around us, the natural history.
I think that's an incredibly important point, because I think there's nothing more satisfying for a young boy than getting his monsters organized.
Yeah, yeah.
There's nothing more of a feeling of sort of, you know, ability to assert oneself over the multiplicity of the world,
right,
and the scariness of the world by organizing it very neatly into the kinds of decks you want, and knowing that the next day you can organize it in yet another way.
Exactly. And I think that's you know, you mentioned dinosaurs, but of course that's when people are really into dinosaurs, they're very much about knowing and identifying each dinosaur and its characteristics and what it does and how it relates to other dinosaurs, right? And it's really the same impulse, but in an infinite variety.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe we've uncovered what it means to be a folklorist, that you like to organize a lot of stuff that otherwise is somewhat disorganized, because it doesn't come to us in the canonical form, the forms that we think of in the more institutionalized forms. So you're sort of like the person going around and organizing all the disorganized parts of culture for us.
Well, I think there are a lot of folklorists who do that. And actually, there's a whole history of what they call motif indexes and tale type indexes. But I'm not very good at that. I'm not very well organized. So my own interest actually is in the objects themselves, kind of in a disorganized fashion, but also in the desire to organize them, discourses with which people approach these otherwise chaotic world systems and try to organize it.
Absolutely.
So, I'm not good at organizing myself, but I'm good at thinking about how other people are organizing.
Right. Exactly. Good at locating the desire to organize.
Right,
so
exactly.
Locating that desire.
Exactly.
Terrific. Well, I want to thank Michael Dylan Foster for coming on the show today. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure.
Yeah. And this show will be archived on officehourucdpodcast.com. officehourucdpodcast.com, and there will be a link to your website that anybody can learn more about your particular articles, because we only touched on two of the four articles you gave me, so there's lots of other interesting material about Japanese folklore. And we will be back next week. We will knock on a different door, so we look forward to our, having you join us next Tuesday. In the meantime, stay tuned for our very own KDVS Radio Theater. And so I guess go out and think about organizing your monsters until next week.
Great. Thank you very much.
Okay. Bye-bye.